there were implements of death everywhere. Rockets, mortar shells, grenades, cases of ammunition for every revolver and rifle and machine gun in the Soviet Army.
Ooh, now this is what you call armaments. Makes our stockpile back in Century City look like shit.
Only they ain't gonna have none in about 10 minutes. I'll set mine up. How much time we got?
Not enough.
The two men did their work efficiently, placing explosives for several hundred feet along the rows of hardware, each globe of explosive with a small radio-controlled firing device stuck in the center.
All right, let's get back. Rock's not gonna wait for us at the top.
Let me just set this anti-personnel device at the door. You know, in case anybody pokes their face in ahead of schedule. And done.
Ready?
Ready.
Shit, they must have called backup.
Off cover, go!
Norton edged around the wood-frame doorway and looked out. The free fighter sat motionless, as if he were resting. Only his face was gone, blown away by an exploding 9mm slug. Norton stared down at his friend. Only now, there was nothing there. The life was gone. He stared, hypnotized.
Shit! Goodbye, Sanford.
He turned and ran up the stairs, two at a time. There were 40 flights to go, and he knew Rock would have no choice but to leave once the allotted time was up. Rock sat at the controls of the KGB commander's private jet helicopter on the roof landing pad that they had found guarded by only three Reds. A fortunate stroke of luck. He looked at his watch. Where the hell were Sanford and Norton? Smith and McCaughlin had arrived with only a few scratches. They had to go. Reinforcements had to be coming, in the hundreds.
Hey!
Norton came hobbling out of the stairwell roof door. He ran to the chopper and dove into waiting arms, which pulled him briskly aboard.
I'm it. They got Sanford.
Don't worry, Norton. We'll get him back.
Rock took up and off like a bolt, tilting the copter forward for maximum airspeed. In the air, he could see the rows of troop trucks and tanks pulling up around the KGB center on all sides.
Good. All the better to view the fireworks.
What's that?
Nothing, Norton. You all set down there?
Yes. Sanford and me load her up the tits.
From what you told me, all the plastique's on the same frequency to blow. Yours, and the stuff I set in the computer room, and downstairs.
Yeah, everything will go at once. It's guaranteed, Rock.
Why don't you do the honors?
Roxon handed Norton the cigarette-pack-sized radio detonator. Norton took the device and stared out of the window at the dump below as Roxon flew a fast, wide circle around the complex.
This is for you, Sanford. 1,000 dead Russians.
Roxon cut on the twin booster jets in the tail of the MS-20, and it roared forward, quickly picking up to 600 kilometers an hour, far faster than any of the regular choppers that might pursue them. He took a final look over his shoulder at the still unfolding carnage. A ball of flame 300 feet high burned with the intensity of a Death Star. The explosions continued, one after another, spreading to other parts of the fort. They had really hurt the bastards this time. Half the fort would be gone by the time this thing blew itself out. It had been a break finding the jet copter on the pad when they blasted their way back to the roof. The power of the machine was incredible. Rock had to keep his hands gripped to the controls as it bucked beneath him. The ground sped by below as if he were flying a jet, and Rock took the chopper up fast and high at a steep angle that made the men in the back gulp and swallow uncomfortably. They quickly left the Stalinville fort and headed out toward the canyons and wild country where they could lose themselves if anyone tried to follow. Rock checked the scanning radar and saw something coming in fast from behind. By their speed, jets.
Detroit, hit the rear gunner position.
On it. Damn, we got everything. Let's see. Get air, guided, activate lock, laser.
two laser-guided missiles shot out from underneath the chopper and headed straight back to greet the two pursuing aircraft.
Good shooting, man.
I wish I could feel proud of Pathwall. But to be honest with you, the Reds built these missile gizmos simple. If they didn't, the Russian crews would be blowing themselves up all over the place.
The rest of the journey home was uneventful, other than several dozen heart-wrenching turns in a half-shot helicopter down narrow, dark canyons. At last, they were climbing toward Century City. Radio silence was maintained, but Rock knew that gun units down on the ground were keeping a wary eye on the descending helicopter. He landed the bird near the camouflaged hangar in which were stored two other helicopters, much smaller ones, and a prop plane. The bird had scarcely touched down when 50 men, their rifles trained on the chopper, approached in a closing circle. Detroit jumped out first, then McCaughlin and the others. The Century City defense crew embraced the returning attack force and stared with wonder at the super chopper.
This is Commander Polikopov's personal helicopter. Make sure she's treated with the royalty she deserves. And a wax job.
The crew had returned to Century City in their newly acquired MS-20 helicopter to much fanfare. It would join their two other smaller helicopters and a prop plane in their growing air force. The men they had rescued, Bill Fitz, Pete Scranton, and Gil, told of their horrifying experiences as guinea pigs for the scientists who were doing the experimental work with the Mindbreaker. Armstrong had been the first subject of the advanced model, MB-2. Since the prisoners were all going to be put to death anyway, after the experiments, the scientist in charge, Letvok, explained the function of the Mindbreaker Model 2, how it would not only probe the brain, but activate primitive fear mechanisms in the medulla, bringing hidden nightmares into the awakened state. Armstrong hadn't cracked. He hadn't told his tormentors the location of Century City, even under the pain of endless torment from whatever horrified him most. Who knows what nightmares the man was living, even up to the moment Roxon had dispatched him with a shot to the temple. Brave till the end. Next, it had been Pete Scranton. Letvok had designed the Mindbreaker to alternate patterns of pleasure and pain deep within the brain. The machine played its game in Scranton's brain, and every 10 or 15 seconds, the expressions on his face had changed from anguished grimaces to unparalleled ecstasy. Then, the Reds had left him there for 10 minutes to scream his voice raw, the dial set to unmentionable pain and agony. Then, between sessions, the Free Fighters had rescued him. He had been given Century City's best rehabilitation suite, but he was still confused and withdrawn. He could be like that for a while, if not forever. But Century City was safe. Roxon pressed his palm against a wall sensor, and the detention room door slid open. Inside, the captured Letvok sat on a wood chair. He turned and smiled. Roxon icily eyed the man up and down. The cigarette dropped from the fingers of the Russian scientist. Fear widened his eyes as Rock rolled up his sleeves to reveal thick, rippling muscles. Roxon approached the Mindbreaker scientist with balled fists. Letvok's sneer melted from his face. When Roxon left 10 minutes later, he felt a little guilty, but only a little. He had stopped short of finishing Letvok. There would be enough time to nurse him back to health. Then Letvok would serve as the subject of the Mindbreaker they had taken from the Stalinville lab and brought back with them. There was much that had to be learned about this machine, and its operating secrets would be pried out of Letvok with his own device. It would be poetic justice. It was Roxon's second day of R&R back at Century City. It had been a long time since he had been able to just sit, think, let his body uncoil. He spent hours in the meditation chamber, a small, sparse white room decorated with only a pillow in the center and a sprig of fresh flowers at one end set on a small black table. Letvok, meanwhile, at the other end of the city, in one of Schechter's labs, was spilling the beans about the Mindbreaker, its operation, modification program, and the ways in which the Reds were implementing it. Schechter had read the statements of the freed American hostages and was therefore totally committed to using the device on Letvok. His normally humanitarian scruples were somewhat dulled by the brutal realities of the Russian torture factory, which had been managed by Letvok. The buzzer on Roxon's wrist phone, worn only inside Century City where the low-level frequency wouldn't be picked up by the Reds, went off with a humming beep.
Yes?
Roxon, this is Rath. Expedition 5 is back, and I think you'll want to hear their report. In fact, you'd better come take a look at what they found.
What'd they find?
Rock, it's quite... Well, we're having the first debriefing in Intelligence Room C.
Right, I'm coming.
Roxon rolled on a civilian white cotton shirt over his muscular frame and was off. Expedition 5 had been headed by a tough but untested young man, Walt Brady, Rock remembered. It had headed out into the northwest, unexplored territory. It was their most ambitious expedition so far, a 1,300-mile trek into the hot zone. There were rumors about that area, that it was the home of the Glowers, that no man had ever returned from there. But Brady, if he had done nothing else, had accomplished that. Roxon went up the four levels to the intelligence section and entered the debriefing room. Rath sat in a broad plastic chair with the five remaining members of the expedition across from him. The five were bearded, though they were also freshly bathed and patched up and outfitted in crisp, new white clothes. They stood up as the military commander of Century City entered. Roxon motioned for them to sit and walked over to Rath's left, sitting down next to Shannon, the intel chief's right-hand woman. She gave Rock a warm and melting look with her fathomless green eyes. He responded with a deprecating grin. Rock snapped his head forward and looked at the five returned free fighters. Brady had been an arrogant young upstart before he left, too sure of himself. Now he had changed. He had the eyes that you get when you see things no man had seen. Eyes like rocks. Premature wrinkles etched the young man's darkly tanned face. Brady leaned forward toward Rock, unblinking. He had lost any traces of fat. Now, muscle and guts lay under those coveralls.
So what'd you see?
Rock, it's incredible out there, the things we've seen. I don't quite know where to start.
Brady, why don't you just begin with your departure from Century City? We need every bit of intel from you to add to our central files, and particularly the extension of our mapping data. I trust you kept full compass and landmark records.
Got it all right here, sir. Here you are, Rath.
Thank you, Brady.
Well, we headed due west for almost 200 miles. In that direction, the land really grew back. We saw deer, raccoon, birds, even berries and sassafras. Things I'd just read about in the books. It's all out there. After less than a day on the open brush country, we encountered some heavy hit zones. The Reds must have dropped two or three within a 30-mile radius. The land was wrecked, a sickly gray color, like ash left out in the rain. Nothing grew there, nothing normal. There was some sort of algae growth, big blankets of a green-red plant that just lived on top of the radioactive dirt. The radiation grew intense very quickly, and we suited up with the anti-rad Dr. Schechter provided. We had to stay sealed for 2 days, drinking only the water we carried. We didn't dare stop for sleep, but just kept going. It was too far to turn back. We'd either make it to some hospitable spot or, well... Strangely, we found water in an unexpected place, to say the least. We came upon three immense volcanoes, must have been created from the H-blasts. One was active, or had been recently. The ground was hot, and inside lava was still bubbling, sending up clouds of steam. The volcano had also created underground springs around the area, some of which fed right out of the side of the crater, hot but drinkable. We camped in one of the dead volcanoes and filled the hybrids with water. We got out of the dead zone by nightfall the next day. We had fairly clear going again for about a day and a half, mostly savanna-type terrain. We took photos, but lost the canister in a fall. Sorry. Then we came upon a pink mist. It was like a fog, so thick you couldn't see more than 3 or 4 feet in front of you. We used the compass to get through, and it wasn't dangerous or anything, just tough to see. As we descended, at probably 500 feet an hour, the fog lifted from around us. It covers this whole area, Rock, acts as a sort of greenhouse effect. Lets heat and an eerie pinkish glow come through, then keeps it all contained. We were in temperatures and humidities I never felt except in the steam baths here. It was a veritable sauna, and as we went on, we came upon something unbelievable. Dense jungle as far as the eye could see. Trees, vines, screaming birds and insects everywhere. And most of the inhabitants of the place were big. Giant bees 2 feet big, moths with wings as big as newspapers, velvet-winged dragonflies as big as a man's leg, and vines and ferns everywhere. There were ferns that must have been 100, 150 feet high, like prehistoric earth. Hell, the whole area looked primeval. As we went in further, there were these creepers everywhere. We had to hack our way through. The first night camping in the jungle, we noticed that the tips of the vines were moving. And as it got darker, the damn things grew right into our encampment. We would have been smothered by morning if not for taking turns burning the things away and hacking at them with machetes. They're apparently carnivorous. Some sort of walking Venus's flytrap. I don't know if they have a taste for humans or not, but we didn't give them a chance to find out. Kept some of us up the night, but by daybreak they stopped moving. I guess they were sleeping. We moved on for the next few days without incident, making good time until we came to a wide, roaring river. We had to stop for nearly a day to make a raft, capable of carrying us and the hybrids across the river. Then, again, it was vast, empty stretches populated only by strange vegetation that kept changing every 20 or 30 miles. Finally, Draper, hand me the map, will you? Thanks. Here, at the very left edge of the map, by the mountains, at this point, we found footprints. Little ones, but human. We spent a day and a half tracking the prints. The ground was black here, Rock. It was the deadest looking soil I've ever seen. Not a damn thing grew here. We finally caught up with a guy. Never saw anything like him, or it, before. He was about 3 feet tall, and here are some sketches.